Pick session number 11364, reel 3.
We were coming back, flying south to north, flying very low on the sand dunes there, and we came over the top of them, and right in front of us, absolutely perfectly set, with one exception, had they been mobile, it'd been better, was a complete German convoy. Unfortunately, it was stationary. We had 10 airplanes, some had 12 guns, some had 8 guns, so you can see we had 100 guns firing, which must have been terrifying on the ground, yet they fired back, hit me in the oil sump. I didn't know this, of course, at the time, but one airplane went down a little way away from the pilot got back, in actual fact, and I was sitting in the oil sump, as I've said, and when we got back to base, which wasn't very far down in the desert, we were at forward post there, about half a gallon of oil fell out of the bottom of mine, and that was it. But we were fortunate in that one pilot, I thought, hit the top of a truck, because his propeller was 11 inches off each of the blades. It was a wooden propeller, but he told me later he'd hit the ground. And he came back with that, and there was me with one hole in the oil sump, and him with a half a propeller. So we took the propeller off my airplane, put on his. We couldn't do what they should have done, is engine shock tests and things from hitting the ground, but it seemed all right, so that made a serviceable airplane. And we put this half a propeller on my airplane, and we took it back. We emptied the thing out and took it back to base, and it flew very well. Vibrated a bit if you could only go certain speed, but it took off. What happened really, I said, we'd pull the wheels up if it weren't off by the certain spot, but it was off way before that. It was very light and no drag, and we got it back to the MU. A new engine was fitted, new propeller, and we had another aeroplane, which could have been lost as easy as thinking.
When was that, do you think, approximately?
When Rommel first, shortly after, in actual fact, sorry, shortly after Rommel did his push from Benghazi, we'll say, it was just the other side of Benghazi coming back. That would be in the 42, I suppose, early 42.
How often would you come across the German Air Force and have to fight a dogfight with them in the Western Desert?
Well, when we first got out there, not a lot. But it increased, of course, when they got these 109s, and they were doing more damage then with us. I can't really answer how often, but it was fairly frequently on the thing.
Who would you say had control over in the air over the desert?
When the 109s were going strong, we were much of a muchness. Through the luck of the draw, where you happened to be at the time. If you met their full force, we were in problems. But if you... I don't know. Naturally, we thought we had control at the time. It's only books I've read since that have changed my mind on that one. But... they were fairly strong. You know, when Rommel came and took over and he got everything out there that he wanted, and when they made the advance all the way to Alamein, we always thought that we could hold our own, but I don't know. I suppose we must have done, really.
Did you make any contingency plans for being shot down over the desert if you had to march over waterless areas?
Well, we not in that way. We had water bottles that we could carry. Yes, that's about all we had. And of course, we had escape maps, and we had our intelligent maps, which you use as a scarf or was sewn in your linings for really getting out of Greece or anywhere over that way. For escaping, if one. Plus, we had money to bribe any of the tribes. But, no, I can't recall really taking iron rations or water or anything in that way. No. But that is possibly because I've often said, thank heavens, it might not be a good thing, but we all had the outlook, I believe, that it would happen to you and not to me, which I think is a British way of looking at it.
What were the losses like in your squadron in the Western Desert?
We lost a few, but I suppose overall it was similar to the ones here. You'd have a bad day and lose two or three, and then you would go on for a time and lose an odd one here and there. I really can't tell you that. I've never totted it up.
Did you ever operate over the Mediterranean against the German convoys supplying Rommel?
We covered our own convoys in the Mediterranean.
To Tobruk?
Well, to Tobruk, yes. But, I mean, our own convoys used to come all the way down the coast, the Egyptian coast and whatnot. We covered them there. But I suppose you've reminded me there of from Mersmith. That was a bad time, really. We used to cover a little lighter going into Tobruk, when Tobruk was surrounded, I'm talking about, doing 5 knots in the bay there. And this would be evening time, you see, and the sun was always the wrong way. And you went, covered this thing, just plodding along there. We'd get in at night and come out again in the morning. We took our turns with other squadrons of landing, when we'd done this, and landing at dusk at Sidi Barani. Now, there was nothing there. We had to take a blanket with us and sleep under the wing of the airplane as best you could. And you were always very pleased when dawn was coming. The airplanes were refilled and rearmed if necessary there. And you took off again as soon as you could see and covered this lighter coming out of Tobruk. Well, the 109 airfields were just up the way, so it was a very dicey operation, and we lost a few people on that. I don't know, but we had a certain amount of success, I suppose, because the lighters got in and out anyway. But it wasn't a very pleasant time at all, because it was such a strain on your eyes. You were looking in the sun in the mornings and in the evenings, you see. And after a day of doing that, doing a trip, as I've said, night and morning, the whites of your eyes were completely red. You know, so we often used to say, I wonder how this is going to affect our eyesight later on in life, but it seems to be all right, so.
I think that you changed over to Tomahawks at one stage. Can you tell me about
that? Well, eventually we were... We spent, go back a moment to Johnny Johns and myself again. We joined the squadron at the beginning of the war, and it was 1942, after we'd been flight commanders for a long time, that we were ordered away, really, for a rest, you see. It was that the time prior to that was before the medical people stepped in and said you can only do so many hours or so many, such a period, you know, on the thing, and then you've got to go for a rest. We had discussed this, it may be of interest to some, that we discussed this at great length, and we'd seen so many people, good chaps, first-class pilot, go for a rest and come back after 6 months and get shot down in the first week they were back. We decided, rightly, wrongly, or as long as we could anyway, we would stay put and call it a day when it was all over. It didn't work like that, but we thought we would. But I believe we stayed too long, because eventually in 42 we were posted and eventually ended up at Gordon's Tree at an OTU, an operational training unit at Gordon's Tree in the Sudan. The temperatures were vile when we got down there. You couldn't sleep at night, and we were more tired than we thought we were, both of us. But that's when I became a Tomahawk flight commander at this OTU. Johnny had the Hurricane flight, I had the Tomahawk flight, and we stayed there, and I left in December 42 to go back to the desert. And that is when I should have taken over 250 Squadron, which were Kitty Hawks. But I went back to hospital in Cairo and had a foot operation. And when I came out of there, they wouldn't let me back in the desert because the foot took some time to heal up properly and they didn't want sand and stuff and the rough living up there. So I found myself as a chief test pilot at a maintenance unit, flying all sorts of American aircraft.
What did you think to the Tomahawk?
Well, Tomahawk was a very good airplane. Marvelous fighting airplane. It had the cannons, bigger guns than we had, and it did remarkably well in the desert. No doubt about that. Lots of pilots didn't like it because it would turn around and bite you if you weren't concentrating properly when you landed. It would swing like mad. That is why it wasn't very popular at the OTU, really.
In what way would it swing?
Well, if you got the tail down, and the tail wheel wasn't exactly straight, it just whipped around on you and then wrote the undercarriage off. You see, we had many an accident at the OTU like that. Nothing terribly serious, but they broke the airplane.
Was it used mainly for ground attack work in the desert? It
was used for both, same as the other fighter. I made just like Hurricane. And the Tomahawk squadrons did very well, and the Kid Hawk squadrons did well.
How did the Tomahawk compare with the 109?
Just like a Hurricane and Spitfire with the 109, I would say. On the thing, not much between any of them, really. And the Tomahawk, you see, had this gun that fired the bigger guns, and they had .5 ammunition, you see, which helped a lot. And, I mean... No, they were... They had a very proud record in the desert.
Can you tell me about this special flight stripped Spitfire 9 with 80 Squadron?
Well, when I to continue, just to lead up to that a moment, when I was doing this test pilot's job, the CO of 80 Squadron, who had been trained with me at Shawbury, was... And was also in 229 Squadron with me for a long time. And he went off to take a Tomahawk flight when I took the flight in 229 Squadron. He came down and had lunch with me one day and said that he was getting these special aircraft and he wanted a flight commander. So I said, I'm your man, you see. So I joined 80 Squadron anyway. And the story behind this really was that a maintenance unit in the Middle East, the Germans started flying over Ju-86 special airplanes that had pressure cabins. They were really a civilian airplane adapted to this thing. And they were high-flying to take photographs, you know, reconnaissance. And we couldn't get anywhere near them with normal airplane. So some test pilots at a maintenance unit had one airplane, or a couple possibly, I don't know how many, modified. And they went up and chased this thing and they shot one down. And from that it grew that we had about four of them, I suppose, eventually. And I was given this flight. And I took the first one to port side. And again, this is another one that I do not understand the German outlook on the thing. This was just prior to the invasion of Sicily. Port Said Harbour was absolutely full of ships, navy, merchant ships, and everything to do with the invasion. They were outside in the Mediterranean. They couldn't get them all in the harbour. They were all the way down the 100 miles of the Suez Canal. And from the height we were going, you could see all this. It was a magnificent sight, but you could walk from one ship to the other. So if you came over with a bomber, you couldn't miss. And one day... this Ju-86 came over, and I personally went up and chased the thing. And I didn't really get up to high enough for it. We're getting fairly close to it. And what we used to do then, when it was going home, you see, you fired the guns just in desperation, hope like mad you could make a hole in the pressure cabin where we had Spitfires down below waiting for it, you see. Anyway, on this occasion, I just fired. In the middle, you fired. You only have one gun on the Spitfire. They were stripped, you see. All armour plating thrown out. Everything that you could do to lighten the thing was out, with one gun left. And get as high as you could. But we didn't have a pressure cabin, you see. And up we went. As far as I'm concerned, the German airplane flew home. And that night, a captain from a merchant ship in Portside in a club there said to me, "Did I think they'd be bombed?" And I said, "I'm absolutely certain you'll be bombed tonight." Knowing my way, nothing happened. And they were there for days, several days anyway. And then they all took off, and we went with them out to sea. Covered them all the way up the coast, and they were attacked some time later on the thing, which I found most extraordinary business. But we had a certain amount of success with these things. We got to three Germans over a period of time by doing just what I said, of getting this airplane up as high as possible and having a bang and getting a hole in the pressure. They had to come down, and we had two Spitfire 5s down below to finish them off. So I suppose it worked. But I think when I came back after the war, after this one, and I was in operational requirements, part of my job was working with the Institute of Aviation Medicine and was dealing with high flying. Maybe I got it because of the job I've been doing. And I learnt more there in a very short time. Had I known when I was flying the Spitfire, because I once got it to 41,500 feet and no pressure. And believe you me, it's a very uncomfortable setup because you can't, you're blowing all round, you see, with no pressure in your body. The airplane was hanging there. You felt if you coughed, it would fall out of the air, you see. We could have done a lot of trouble, but we didn't stay up there long enough, fortunately, because I learned from Farnborough that had you stayed up there any length of time, that you'd have, the white corpuscles and the red ones wouldn't have mixed, you know, or would have split up and whatever they do to, and could have fixed it. But we didn't know anything about that. All we had was a normal oxygen mask and off went. But the big problem with it, and it happened on one occasion to me with an Australian pilot, the Germans didn't have enough airplanes to send any over. You know, if they came two or three times a week, that was about it. And the drill was, and I told all my pilots, as I was instructed, that if they did a trip like that, land wherever they wanted to, because you didn't quite know where you were going to be, Egypt and along the coast or somewhere, land at the nearest airfield, stay and take your time, not the normal way of quickly rearming and coming back or anything, take your time and come back quietly and report when you get back what it's all about. Well, one day this happened. Chappie landed, he was away in lunch, he came back and he landed. And on reflection, all I can say is he came in a little bit fast. Nothing to worry about. He landed okay and he got out, and I went out to meet him to find out what had happened in the morning. And the first thing he did was throw his arms around my neck. And I thought, dear, oh dear, he'd been drinking, you see, but there was no smell of any alcohol or anything like that. But if ever you'd seen a man drunk without having any alcohol, it was him. And I had to gently lead him into a tent and sit him down. And he hadn't had anything at all. And this was lack of oxygen, you see. I should have said, when he was on his way back in the afternoon, there was another one came over, the only time it ever happened. And he went up after it, although we had another one doing it. But he heard it on the radio, so he went up high again. And this was the result, you see, and he came in like that. And it was quite a lesson to everybody, really and truly. And he didn't feel well for a couple of days. But, fortunately, no more. He was all right after that. But it was quite a dicey thing. But that's the story of that one, really.
You were with 33 Squadron at Bursis. Where's Bursis?
Just near Benghazi. It's on the coast road there. That's where the squadron was based when I took it over.
And this was after the collapse of the Germans in North Africa?
Yes, yes. They were proceeding up the way. But 33 Squadron stayed there with the intention, which I learned as soon as I dig it out, of going to Sardinia. Now, Sardinia was behind the German lines. And we were all packed up shortly after I took it over to go to Sardinia. And we were on sort of 24 hours notice with everything loaded and all this sort of business. And this went on for a time, and then we were taken off that. And we eventually moved to Mersmatru, back to where we started, to go to the island of Kos when we were going to take those islands, the Aegean Islands. We didn't go, fortunately. 74 Squadron went off, and the Germans that night, saboteurs, pulled the, whatever it was, I'd say, pulled the plug out. They landed on salt, dried up Salt Lake, you see, and it was flooded, and they lost all their aircraft, and some of them got out in boats and things like that, but we didn't go. And that is when we came back to, shortly after that, I got instructions to come back to this country. Whilst we were at Bursis, point of interest there, we suddenly got a call from Y Service, the intelligence service, that a convoy 160 miles out at sea was going to be attacked at dusk. Could I do anything about it? So I got all every serviceable airplane we had, and off we went. Just as shortly after we got out, these 88s arrived. There was quite a lot of cloud, and they saw us, unfortunately, and they dropped their bombs. The first I saw were bombs 2 or 3 miles away from the convoy, hitting water going up. And then an old airplane, and they were really, they either dropped it through the cloud or some came below. One of my flights knocked down one Ju-88. And we damaged some others, but I don't know what happened to them on the setup. And we all came back and landed in the dark. And I was so cheered when we didn't lose anybody and we didn't break any airplanes, which was quite a feat on that one. A few days later, I got a call from Middle East. The convoy had arrived at Alexandria in Egypt. And in this convoy, there was an American ship. It was the first time they'd seen any action. And they had a whip around, and they gave the senior officer at Alexandria, RAF officer, £1,000 to go to any dependents of pilots who had been lost in that action. Well, we didn't lose anybody. I tried desperately to get some money for the squadron, but they really went into the benevolent fund. That was, I thought, a typical American gesture. You know, they'd come straight from America and they hadn't seen anything, but they saw us milling around there that night, and so that helped.
And then 33 Squadron returned to Britain?
Yes, we came back to Britain, and we went to North Weald. Now, all my squadrons, all my pilots, only had two or three from this country. All the rest was, I had two South Africans, Australians, Canadians, New Zealanders, two New Zealand flight commanders, all been trained out in the Middle East and whatnot, and hadn't seen a cloud in their life. See? We came back to North Weald. We re-equipped with Spitfire 9s. I got the troops away for a week's leave anyway, the first thing. And some of them had been out there 5 years. Most of them for 3 years anyway, as I had. And we came back, got them away for a week's leave. I got 5 days leave because I had to stay and the new wing commander flying the next day and also come back a day early. But that's neither here nor there. We stayed at North Weald doing a bit of training and re-equipping with these things for about a week or 10 days. And then we were posted to Lym in Kent, which was the nearest airfield to the enemy at that time, 44. We did sweeps over France, escorted bombers, and we used to drop bombs ourselves. 500-pound bomb under the Spitfire and go out and try and do that. So we continued doing that.
Did you have much success with that?
We didn't see any German aircraft on that period.
But with the bombing?
Oh, yes, we did, after the first go. I was the only chap in the squadron that ever dropped a bomb from a Spitfire at the start. And twice I got the range just north of the Thames, and twice to get some practice in beforehand, you see, but twice the cloud base was 800 feet, so I couldn't use it. So then I got permission to go out and get a reasonable target, like a railway yard, which we did do, and see what we could do there. Well, the first time, the bombs went all over the place, but after that, we got it fairly well buttoned. And
how did fighter pilots like using the Spitfire as a bomber?
Oh, very much over there. We had great fun. Well, when they say great fun, that's wrong. There was no problem in that. Some of the targets were difficult to find. That was the problem that I had, because the maps we were given and the pinpoints for them had been taken some months before the photographs that we had. But our bomber command were knocking all skittles off the thing out there, because they were trying to stop the V1s coming over, you see, and that's what we were helping them to do in our little way. But we also did a lot of patrols looking for convoys, but they were very scarce in the daytime. They didn't move a lot. We did one or two where we would drop the bomb on, stop them going up the road if we could, and then strafe them, you see. That was our line then. And this went on until D-Day.
What kind of targets were you looking for with the Spitfires when you were dropping the bombs?
Looking for convoys on the freelance ones that you could have. But you had to, it's no good dropping 12 bombs on one vehicle. You had to find a convoy of reasonable size and then see what you could do with that. But we went out and we dropped, we were given pinpoints for V1 ammunition dumps and sites and things like that. And also we did quite a lot before D-Day, carry up the coast towards Dunkirk of any radar stations or anything in that way. I believe it was done to try and push, now, I didn't realise at the time, nuisance value, and to make the Germans think that they were coming across there. It was just another pinprick towards that, I think.
So it was a kind of decoy?
Absolutely, yeah. That's what I think, anyway. I've never been explaining. And, well, then that leads us on, I think, to D-Day, when three squadrons at Lim. I was the fortunate one and drew the long straw. And in the afternoon, we went out with the gliders on D-Day afternoon, which is I'm pleased we managed to do that. It was a fantastic sight.
The gliders that went to Pegasus Bridge?
The army, well, no, the ones that went to the beachhead after the bridge thing. They went out, hundreds of them. I mean, it went on all the afternoon. And there were fighters in front, there were fighters all the way. We were in the middle. I was going to say thousands, I don't know, but the air was full of aeroplanes. And but again, you see, there was no German aircraft around at all. We never saw any. And we went over to the beachhead and watched these poor gliders going down and being shot down and crashing and landing, of course. But quite a sight that was. And then after that, we continued to do our sweeps over France and as soon as they got themselves established with landing strips out there, we would go to the beachhead, patrol the beachhead, our ships over there, we had a standing patrol over them all the time, you see, of different squadrons, and then land at the beachhead and refuel and do another one and probably two more and then come home, you see. And we did that for quite a time.
So by this time, the German Air Force seemed to be well and truly beaten.
Oh, yes, it was. I came home in, what was it, April?
To Britain.
To Britain, and, the end of April, and we'll say May, and I left the squadron in August.